A very pleasant good evening to each of you. It's good for us to be together, and since this is the last service in our series of studies together this week, I want to say that I appreciate having been able to be with you. It's been a pleasure to get to know you, and I appreciate your having asked me to come your way. I know there's always a risk involved when you really don't know much about somebody at the personal level, and your invitation for somebody to come is sometimes based upon the recommendation of a particular individual. In this case, I expect it was Rick Boswell, and he's no longer here. And so I appear on somebody else's recommendation, and you've got to take the consequences for good or ill. So I hope that you don't think less of Rick now as a result of our having been together. But it's been very pleasant for me, and I've enjoyed getting to know you a little bit and to see a little bit of the work that you're doing together in this community. And it's encouraging to me to see what you are doing. Certainly encourage you to keep doing that and to let the light of the Lord's word shine brightly from your midst in this community. We'll certainly continue to remember you and pray for you and for your work, and I would appreciate if you would remember me once in a while in your prayers and the work that I try to do in various places. We're going to end tonight by talking about a very familiar passage in Galatians chapter 6 and verse 9. Galatians 6 and verse 9, where Paul says, "Let us not grow weary while doing good, for in due season we shall reap if we do not lose heart." If somebody were to ask you why you serve the Lord, why are you a Christian, what would you say? Now, there are all kinds of blessings and benefits that come from the gospel. Some things that we enjoy immediately in the here and now, other things that will only be ours in eternity. Where do you put the emphasis? Do you serve the Lord primarily for the short-term benefits that we have in the here and now? Or do you take a longer view, and your primary concern is being with God in eternity? That is an important question. If nothing else, just to honestly address that issue in our own hearts and minds. Why we do what we do in regard to God, you know, motives make a big difference, don't they? It's important not only what we do in this world, but why we do it. So we need to think about what our primary motives are. You may remember in the Old Testament, in the book of Job, that the devil insinuated that Job only served the Lord because the Lord had richly blessed him with temporal blessings, and implied that if those blessings would be withdrawn, then Job wouldn't serve the Lord. I mean, his argument was, well, yes, Job is faithful. Why wouldn't he be? Lord, you've paid him handsomely to serve you. But see what would happen if you took away those blessings. Well, if you know the story of the book of Job, you know that God gave Satan permission to afflict Job very terribly and took away from him all of the earthly blessings that he had been enjoying except his life. God prohibited Satan from taking his life, but nearly everything else was taken away from him, and Job remained faithful. His faith was what it ought to be. He wasn't just serving God because it paid him nicely to do that. He had a much longer view of why he was faithful to the Lord. Well, it is true, isn't it, that righteousness has its rewards. Hebrews 11 verse 6 says that God is a rewarder of those who diligently seek him. But the primary reward that comes from serving the Lord is not in this life, is it? It will be when this life is over. And so Paul says here in this passage that I want us to look at tonight, "Let us not grow weary while doing good, for in due season," That is, when the time comes, when the right time comes, we shall reap the harvest if we do not lose heart. I want us to think tonight about the fact that we need to learn patience. That's a biblical word that I think, when we see that in the New Testament, we use the word patience a little bit differently today than what it means when we see it in the New Testament. We usually think of patience as just the ability to wait in a long line, or to wait when there's a frustrating delay that we wish would hurry up and disappear. That's one kind of patience. I learned more about that kind of patience than I ever knew before several years ago when I got involved in an 11-hour traffic jam due to an ice storm in northern Alabama. I was traveling through, and when I came upon this ice storm and got stuck on the interstate, it was 9 o'clock at night, and it was 8 the next morning before we were able to move. Well, that was a long night. And I was not the only one. There was 10 miles of cars in the very same position. All any of us could do, just sit there and wait until the sun came up the next morning. Well, that is one kind of patience, and most of us could do with a little bit more of that kind of patience. But in the Bible, the word patience basically means endurance of difficulty. It might be the difficulty of waiting, a long time for something to take place, but it could be any other kind of difficulty. So in the Bible, patience means holding up under a heavy load. It means steadfastness and perseverance and the ability to endure when we might be tempted to give up and quit enduring. The patient person keeps on keeping on, as we say. Well, that's the very quality that Job is known for. We talk about the patience of Job. That's exactly what we have in mind. When he was afflicted, when he was called upon to suffer, and his blessings were removed, then he continued to serve the Lord anyway. He endured, it would seem, he was prepared to endure whatever he had to endure without giving up, without renouncing his faith in the Lord. And so the patience of Job is legendary, isn't it? It's the ability to keep on enduring and not give up. Well, a person only is able to do that if he can look to whatever the long-term benefit is of his endurance. You know, a person who's only concerned about what's happening right now won't endure very much. Because when what's happening right now is unpleasant, then that person will give up. They're into momentary rewards and immediate gratification and all of that. But the person who can look beyond whatever may be going on right now to something that's even much more important, but it's not here yet, and he will endure whatever has to be endured in the meantime, that's the kind of person who's going to be faithful to the Lord. And that's the kind of person that Job was. Well, this idea of patience is one of the principal virtues or character traits that we must have. And it's discussed in so many passages of Scripture, because without it, no other virtue is going to do us any good. I don't care what other virtuous character traits you might have. If you're not able to hold out and endure, then you're going to give up before the end of your life, and then you will forfeit whatever benefit there might have been from having any other honorable characteristics to your makeup. Hebrews chapter 6, for example. In fact, the entire book of Hebrews is an eloquent plea to its readers not to give up the faith, even if they were to be persecuted, that they should endure that. And so he says, in chapter 6, for example, at verse 11, we desire that each one of you show the same diligence to the full assurance of hope until the end, that you do not become sluggish, but imitate those who through faith and patience or endurance inherit the promises. So in that verse itself, who are those who inherit the promises? eventually. Those who do that through faith, that is trust and dependence on God, and patience, steadfastness, endurance. And so he appeals to his readers to choose to think that way. Jesus said in Luke chapter 21 and verse 19, by your patience possess your souls. I believe the ESV says, by your endurance you will gain your lives. There is a sense, I think, in which that's what it all comes down to. Whether we have the ability to hold out or not. I've mentioned to one or two of you and been warned not to publicize it too much that I was born up in Hope, Arkansas, not too far from here. That will please some of you. It will not please others of you. I understand that. But I've got a funeral, a cemetery plot up in the old Pleasant Home Church Cemetery up in Pike County, out from Delight, Arkansas, where most of my mother's family were originally from. And I remember several years ago when I was up there and reserved that cemetery plot, the guy that kind of takes care of that cemetery sort of half jokingly said, well, Gary, what do you want us to put on your tombstone? And I said, well, about all you'll be able to put on it, I guess, is at least he didn't give up. I hope that will be able to be said about me. That is no small thing. We don't do anything else if we can keep going and not give up. Endure whatever has to be endured until the end comes. That's no small achievement. And by the Lord's help, that's what we need to determine that we are going to do. But it's a quality that has to be learned. Endurance is. The Bible very often uses the farmer as an example of how that works. You know, people who work with living things and with growing things have to be willing to wait, don't they? You can hurry up physical processes a little bit, I guess, with fertilizer and chemicals that hasten the process along a little bit, but not very much. A farmer basically has to plant and cultivate and then wait until the time that these natural processes have developed, and then there'll be the harvest. There's not much that he can do to alter that process. He's got to work and wait, and as Paul says here in Galatians chapter 6, eventually the harvest will come. In due season it will come if the farmer doesn't give up in the meantime. So farmers have to know about this quality of patience, don't they? Farmers only get their reward at the harvest. They don't get incremental payments from the fields, you know, during the growing season. They get anything at all, it's when the harvest comes in, and until then they have to work and wait for long-term results. The fields don't, you know, keep them going by paying them a little bit as they go. They get what they get at the end by working and having the quality of patience. Can you imagine a farmer who went out into his fields, you know, exasperated halfway through the growing season and said, you know, you ungrateful fields, I have given and given and given to you so far this growing season, and what have you given me in return? Nothing. Well, if the fields could speak, they would say, and you won't get anything until the end of the whole process. You're going to have to be patient. Well, if you turn to James in the New Testament, chapter 5, James uses the farmer as an illustration of that kind of patience. Look at it in James chapter 5 at verse 7. James 5 and 7, he says, therefore, be patient. And by the way, I'm reading from the New King James. You, depending on what translation you're using, you may see some other word where you hear me read the word patient. You may see endurance or steadfastness or something like that. The New King James says, be patient, brethren, until the coming of the Lord. And then he uses the illustration of the farmer. See how the farmer waits for the precious fruit of the earth, waiting patiently for it until it receives the early and the latter rain. So you also be patient. Establish your hearts, for the coming of the Lord is at hand. So do you see how, in this sense, we've got to be more like farmers? willing to work and to wait patiently. But I'll tell you something else farmers have to have in addition to patience, and that is they have to know what trust is. You know, there is no absolute guarantee that the laws of nature will work the same this year that they always have. There's a pretty good track record of those processes working the same way. There's good reason to trust in those principles of agriculture, but there's no absolute guarantee. If a farmer believes that if he plants corn, that corn is going to come up and grow, if he believes that, he will believe it because of trust. He's trusting in principles that have worked in the past, but without any absolute guarantee that it's going to work that same way this year, he's got to believe that it's going to. And he can't, halfway through the growing season, suddenly begin to doubt that these principles are going to work this year. He will have to be a person who patiently trusts principles that have proven reliable for a long, long time, and he can't get weak in faith during the process and give up his hope and his trust in what he's doing. He's got to maintain confidence. And there might be times when the farmer begins to doubt whether this is going to work this year. But if he doesn't have the quality of trust, he's not going to make a very good farmer. It's a risky way to make a living. It requires that a man have the ability to trust. And that's the principle back here in Galatians chapter 6 when Paul uses the illustration of the farmer. Turn back there. We read verse 9, but I want us to back up to verse 7 and look at the context. Galatians chapter 6, beginning of verse 7. Look at the point that he's making here. Do not be deceived. God is not mocked, for whatever a man sows, that will he also reap. For he who sows to his flesh will of the flesh reap corruption. But he who sows to the Spirit will of the Spirit reap everlasting life. Then that's when he says in verse 9, therefore let us not grow weary while doing good, for in due season we shall reap, if we don't lose heart and give up. Now look at what he's saying there. What are the situations where we usually bring that principle out there in verse 7, whatever man sows, that will he also reap? Who are usually the people that we think need to hear that? It's very often the people who are sowing to the flesh, right? And we want them to be warned that if they keep sowing to the flesh, they're going to, of the flesh, reap corruption, because you're going to reap what you're sowing. Well, that's true. That's half of the truth. But what's the half of the truth that he's primarily interested in this passage? Not the warning of the person who needs to hear that if you sow wrongly, you're going to reap a bitter harvest. He's primarily interested to encourage the person who's sowing to the Spirit to keep doing that, trusting that if he'll not give up doing that, he will reap a wonderful harvest when the time comes if he doesn't give up. But in the meantime, what has he got to do? He's got to have enough confidence in the Lord's promise to keep sowing to the Spirit, even if there might be times right now when it doesn't look like that's working out very well. You know as well as I do, don't you, that doing things the Lord's way in the here and now sometimes seems like it makes matters worse for us in this life, right? We know what the Lord says to do. We know how he says to handle certain situations. We know what he says about putting first things first. But it looks like, in terms of short-term results, that doing it the Lord's way might be disastrous. Look at the price I would pay if I did that. How's that going to be good? Trust says, based upon a long track record of the Lord keeping his promise, that even if it doesn't seem in the short term that sowing to the Spirit is going to reap a good harvest, I must keep doing that, trusting that no matter what it looks like right now, if I will keep sowing to the Spirit, the result is going to be good in due season. If not right now, the time will come when that harvest will be reaped, and I'll be mighty glad that I kept sowing to the Spirit at times when it would have been tempting to give up because it didn't seem like it was working out very well. Right? We are tempted, aren't we, to quit doing things the Lord's way, to quit making sacrifices and quit putting first things first, because it seems like that hurts us in the short run. It seems like we pay a price that we don't want to have to pay. Those sacrifices are not worth it. But the principles are proven principles, aren't they? That you reap what you sow eventually. And you can't tell what the harvest is going to be based upon short-term results. Short-term results can be very deceptive. In the stock market, in the soybean field, and in the vineyard of the Lord, you can't pay too much attention to momentary ups and downs and make up your mind on what's going to happen eventually based upon just, you know, the changes of daily life and what seems to be good right now. We've got to trust proven principles and the principles of long-term goals and long-term growth and do what we know is the right thing to do right now in the confidence, as Job had, whether it pays us to do that in the short term or not, that we're not too much concerned about that. We're concerned about the end result. And that will always be governed by the law of the farm. That law cannot be broken in the long term. But you will reap what you have sown. But that's hard. It's hard to put our priorities where they ought to be, to do what we ought to do, regardless of the cost and regardless of the consequences in the here and now. Because it is so easy for us to be so primarily concerned about whether something helps or hurts right now, here today or tonight. What's the price I'll pay there? Or what's the benefit I'll get of that right now? And sometimes that totally governs our decision. And how foolish. How foolish. We've got to look, take a longer view than that if we're going to get to heaven. We need to cultivate, no pun intended, cultivate the patience and the trust of the farmer. And that requires, as I say, taking the long view rather than the short view. Well, that's easy for a preacher to say, but it's hard for any of us to do, isn't it? Including the preacher. Because what happens right now seems so much more real, doesn't it? I mean, immediate gratification seems so much more real and so much more important than heaven. That's way off in the future. It's unseen. It's intangible. Well, yeah, that'd be wonderful. But heaven doesn't nearly have the motivational power that a much, tinier benefit would have if it's right now. We will sometimes trade heaven away for something that seems like that's going to help me right now here today. And we won't make a sacrifice that's going to make life a little bit harder for me right now if all I'm going to get from that is to be with the Lord in eternity. I'm concerned about today. I'm concerned about what helps and hurts in the here and now. It's hard to take the long view of God's blessings, the real rewards of righteousness. It is a fact that doing things the Lord's way won't always work or be effective if we're measuring what works and what's effective in terms of short-term results. Any more than a farmer, could judge whether, a certain fertilizer is the right chemical to use this year based upon whether the crop just grows 6 inches tomorrow. It might not do that. That short-term result might not be forthcoming. Solomon observed in Ecclesiastes chapter 9 and verse 11 that the race is not always to the swift, nor the battle to the strong. You know, in sports, does the best team always win? Not in a single contest. Any number of variables can enter in to alter the outcome of a single contest. And the most skilled team or person won't always win every time because there are just too many variables. That's why in baseball, for example, when we're going to have the World Championship, we play 7 games rather than 1 to even out the variables. Even with 7 games, you know, the best team might not always win 4 out of 7 games, but much more likely that that's going to tell us who's the best team than just 1 contest, because the battle is not always to the strong. The race is not always to the swift. Short-term results are influenced by so many variables that really doesn't tell you much of anything. And it certainly doesn't tell us much of anything in terms of what's right and what's effective in the spiritual realm, does it? And we need to be careful not to take an accusing attitude toward God for his seeming indifference to our problems. And, you know, I hear people sometimes say, well, you know, I've got this problem. And yes, I know what the scripture says about that. I know what's right. But that would be disastrous to do that. That would make the situation worse. And I'll plead with them, well, give it a try. You know, give God's way at least a try before you reject it. And so a person will try it, you know, for a week or 10 days and then come back and say, see, I told you that wouldn't work, you know, and it hasn't. Well, you don't know whether something is going to be effective if you're not willing to wait for a longer term measurement of what's going to work than just today or tomorrow. You remember Moses in Exodus chapter 5, I almost laugh when I read this because I see so much of myself in Moses' response here. You remember the Lord, you know, when the Lord instructed Moses to go down to Egypt and deliver his people, Moses didn't want to do that, did he? Moses made all kinds of excuses why he wasn't the right person to do that. I'm not eloquent. The people won't believe me. Pharaoh will certainly say no. Finally, the Lord insisted, Moses, go. And so Moses went. But Exodus chapter 5 at verse 22, after the first time when Moses had gone in to tell Pharaoh to let the people of Israel go, what was the result? Well, it was exactly what Moses predicted the result would be. Pharaoh had said an emphatic no. So verse 22 of Exodus 5, Moses returned to the Lord and said, Lord, why have you brought trouble on this people? Why is it that you have sent me? For since I came to Pharaoh to speak in your name, he has done evil to this people, and neither have you delivered your people at all. I can just hear Moses saying, Lord, I told you the way this would turn out. You should have listened to me to start with. This is not going well. Well, and it hadn't at that point, right? But the long-term results weren't in yet, were they? God still had some work to do before Pharaoh was going to let the people of Israel go. And Moses was prematurely deciding what would work and what wouldn't. His trust had failed him. His patience had failed him already. and he had to learn that the Lord can be trusted to accomplish his purposes and his promises, but maybe not this morning or this evening. We may need to wait for the end of the story to be told before we make up our minds whether the Lord's way is going to work or not. If we don't have the patience in our lives to wait until the end of the story has been written, we ought not to draw premature conclusions about whether doing God's will pays or not. Paul says, in due season, when the time comes, we will reap if we do not give up. So our emphasis has to be on the end of the story. That's how Jesus got through the trials and the afflictions that he had to endure. All right? What does Hebrews chapter 12, verse 2 say about Jesus enduring his afflictions? How did he do it? It says, "For the joy set before him, he endured the cross, despising the shame." He had to keep his mind's eye fixed on what was beyond the cross. He had a hard time getting the apostles to take that longer term view, didn't he? When he first began to explain to them that he was going to have to be crucified, that didn't seem like a good idea to them, did it? "Lord, that would be disastrous. You have come to be the king. You can't let them put you to death. How can a king be dead?" Well, they had to learn to do what he had to do, and that is to look beyond the difficulties and the pain and the suffering of doing the Lord's will to the time when there will then be the joy and the glory and the crown on the other side of the cross. So we've got to discipline ourselves to do that. Let me tell you, heaven is worth, it is worth whatever hardships have to be endured to get there. And I hope you don't find that statement insulting, because I don't know what your hardships are. You may be sitting there thinking, "Gary, you have no idea what hardships are like." If you thought that, you might not know as much about my life as you think you do. But all of us have difficulties, don't we? Some have very serious difficulties. I look at some people's lives who suffer so much, so often, I just am amazed. I mean, it just seems like in some people's life, the rain pours all the time. And you wonder how they make it from one day to the next. But whatever you have to suffer, whatever I have to suffer, you could take all of what all of us suffer and put it in one big heap. And heaven would be worth that and more. It's going to be worth whatever it takes to keep going. Paul, a man who knew a good bit about suffering, you know anything about his life, you know that it was not easy. I'm ashamed of myself sometimes when I get to complaining and thinking that I have it anywhere near tough when I read Paul's life. If he can say in 2 Corinthians 4, verse 17, "Our light affliction," if his was light, I'm not sure there's a word to describe how light mine is, "but our light affliction, which is but for a moment," he said, "is working for us a far more exceeding and eternal weight of glory." Heaven is going to be worth it. So let me just ask you, if Satan were allowed to do in your life what he was allowed to do in Job's life, and that is start taking away your earthly blessings one by one, how far down the line would he have to go before you quit serving the Lord? Could ask it another way. How much does the Lord have to pay you to keep you on his side? Satan's insinuation with Job was, "Job doesn't serve you for naught, God. You pay him nicely, certainly he will serve you." But the devil found out that all of those blessings would be taken away, and Job would still be faithful, because what he wanted was to see his Redeemer's face when his life was over, whatever that life might be like in the meantime. So what does God have to give us in this life to keep us on his side? Would heaven be blessing enough? Let me ask it this way. Some of you are recently baptized into Christ. It has been a joy to me to meet those of you who are recent converts. Some of you a year or so ago, some of you just a matter of weeks ago. Suppose if you studied with Brian and he showed you from the New Testament that if you obey the gospel, you're going to die immediately when you come up out of the waters of baptism. Would you obey the gospel? Many people honestly would say, well, no, I don't want to die. What I want is that Christianity will give me a much better life in this world. That's what I want. And if this is just about heaven, I'm not interested. Well, folks, it's not just about heaven. The Lord does promise that he will bless us and care for us and love us in this life. He won't shield us from the difficulties that will come from putting him first and serving him faithfully. But we ought to be able to honestly say we would be interested in obeying the gospel if heaven was all that was involved. If the Lord were to say, you obey the gospel, I'm going to be waiting for you at the end of the path, but I'm telling you right now, the path between now and then is going to be horribly painful. Would you obey the gospel? That's the way it turned out for Paul. Probably a blessing that the Lord didn't explain to Paul what his life was going to be like after he became a Christian. But Paul had his priorities straight. He obeyed the gospel for the right reason, and that is to be with the Lord in eternity. Yes, there are blessings in the here and now. There were for Job, and there are for us. But that's icing on the cake. And we ought to be able to honestly say that we would seek the forgiveness of our sins. We would seek to be reconciled to God spiritually so that we could have really the only thing that is promised to all of God's people and only to God's people, and that is the hope of eternity. Everything else is just extra that may come to some of the Lord's people and may not come to others, but the only thing that is promised to all of the Lord's people and only the Lord's people is heaven. And we need honestly to be able to say, that's what I'm in it for, and I will endure until the harvest comes, whatever has to be endured. But we won't be able to say that if we're in it for the wrong reasons. If we're just in it for the short-term benefits, then we won't be any more steadfast and patient than a farmer would be who expects his crop to be finished tomorrow morning, you know, after he just planted it yesterday. It's not the way growth processes work. So, Paul says in 1 Corinthians chapter 15 and verse 58, therefore, my beloved brothers, be steadfast, immovable, always abounding in the work of the Lord, knowing that in the Lord your labor is not in vain. I'm going to tell you, your labor in the Lord is the only thing that you won't leave behind when you do leave this world. Everything else that you've enjoyed, however nice it might have been, is going to be left behind. The only thing you'll have in eternity is your relationship with the Lord. And Jesus was very, very clear in Matthew chapter 16 when he said, if a man were to gain the whole world and lose his soul, it would have profited him nothing. So what are we interested in? And what are we willing to do to persevere until that thing is ours that we began to pursue on the day when we were baptized into Christ? Let us not grow weary while doing good. For in due season we will reap if we don't lose heart. Would you like to know how much longer it will be until the harvest time? None of us do know, do we? I personally don't think I would like to know. There are many days in my life, and I'm just to be quite frank with you here, there are many days in my life when I wish desperately that it would be sooner rather than later. Oh, Lord, come quickly. This world can be hard. And I long for the rest. I long for the reward. But who knows how much work the Lord has for any of us before that time will come. That's not our call to make, is it? We long to be with Him. Paul said to depart and be with Christ is far better. We long for that, but what's our attitude in the meantime? We're willing to stay and work as long as the Lord has work for us to do, longing all the while for the time of harvest. And it will come if we keep working and waiting patiently for the Lord. So whether it be long or short, I say to you, having come to love you very dearly in 3 days, 4 days. Don't give up. Whatever it takes. You live here. You together are the Lord's people in this place. Your circumstances are not perfect. Your locality is not perfect. You are not perfect people. There are challenges, there are frustrations, but here is where you are together as the Lord's people. Keep working, no matter what. And in due season, we will reap if we don't lose heart. And may God bless you as you continue to work and to wait for His return. And may it be sooner rather than later. If we can help you in any way tonight as we sing this invitation song, we hope that you would come to the front and just be honest with us about how we can help you. We will help you in any way that the Lord and the Scriptures will let us help you. But we want to encourage you to do whatever has to be done, obeying the Lord's will, so that you can have the thing that we have. It's the only thing worth having. And that is the hope of life with God when this life is over. We can help you. Won't you come while we stand and sing?